I'm Tavin Nasir, and this is Leadership Biz Cafe, a podcast that provides insights and tools to help leaders take on the challenges and opportunities found in leading today's workplaces. Leadership Biz Cafe is brought to you by Tavin Nasir Leadership, our leadership firm that offers keynotes and corporate trainings in both in-person and virtual settings that will help you to improve the way you lead and guide your organization's growth and future successes. Now, if you've been enjoying my podcast and the insights and tools I've been sharing on how you can improve your leadership craft, and you're interested in having me expand on them with your team and organization, I'd like to invite you to check out my speaking page on our website at tavinnasir.com to learn about some of the topics I can discuss at your upcoming event. And now I'd like to introduce my guest for this episode, Shara Roman. Before establishing the Silverine Group, Shara held executive leadership positions at several renowned organizations, including CGI, Fannie Mae, and Visa. Her insights on organizational culture have been featured in CEO World Magazine, SHRM, HR Executive, and Authority Magazine, to name a few. Shara is also the author of The Conscious Workplace, Fortify Your Culture to Thrive in Any Crisis, which is what Shara and I will be talking about in this episode. Hi, Shara. Welcome to the Leadership Biz Cafe.
Hey, Tanvir. Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to have this conversation with a new friend from Montreal.
So, Shara, before we begin, I have to tell you how much I enjoyed reading your perspectives on topics I often speak about in my keynotes and workshops. Things like the importance of fostering a sense of community and belonging, purpose-led work, and empathy. But I was also so happy to see you challenging the idea of culture fit and advocating instead for culture ad. Now, I'm getting a bit ahead of myself here, as there is something I wanted to use to start a discussion here. So before the pandemic, I don't think many leaders gave culture much thought, aside from seeing someone sharing Peter Drucker's famous quote about strategy and culture. But over the past year, there's been this increased focus on organizational culture as CEOs use it as the rationale for why employees need to return to the office full time, without considering how these mandates were impacting the very culture they were using to justify their decision. Now, the focus of your book is how do we go about creating a conscious culture? But before we get to that, I think it's important that we understand what kind of culture we operate in right now. And in your book, you identify four types of organizational culture. So, Shara, could you help our listeners identify what kind of culture they might be working in by describing these four types of culture?
Yeah, for sure. Thanks. Great question, Tanvir. So, they're sort of one of the ones that I actually find to be quite common in both sort of the organizations we work with and organizations that we look at is what I call sort of the nice, quote unquote, culture. And actually, in one respect, nice stands for not interested to care enough, right? And a nice culture is one that is embodied by, everyone being really nice, everyone's really pleasant, there's no conflict, and actually can feel very sort of warm and friendly, especially at first as you're kind of coming into the organization. But it's really a culture that is represented by decisions not getting made or decisions getting made but unmade because the real conversation is not happening in the room, but it sort of, you know, happens kind of between a couple of people that sort of leave the room and say, okay, well, we didn't really get to all the issues and that was a dumb decision. We're going to do what we want, right? Or it might be that feedback isn't delivered to folks. And you have low performers sitting around, or you have people who actually have a lot of potential, but they're not given the feedback to make the adjustments they need. And so they're not performing at the level they're capable of, right? Which frustrates them and demoralizes them, frustrates their team members and demoralizes them. And you actually sort of have this tailspin. So those are some of the kind of the elements of a nice culture. The other one is the sort of good old boy culture, right? Or sort of the get on board culture, I should say. And that is where you, again, it might come across as a very fun place to be. It might be the kind of place, like especially sort of in the, you know, the 2010s, it was all sort of epitomized with foosball and, you know, kegs of beer and, you know, the refrigerator full of goodies and, you know, kind of golf outings, right? But it's sort of one of those cultures where, yeah, it might be really fun. It might be a very accommodating culture for someone who likes that, right? But if you don't, there isn't sort of a respect for the differences that each of us might have in terms of what's important to us and the kind of environment we want. And it's more like, hey, listen, just get on board, right? Like, if you want to be a part of the team, you've got to come to the happy hours and get drunk. Or, you know, if you want to be a part of the team, it's expected that you're going to go golf with the gang. And, you know, those don't work, right? And those don't work particularly for people who might be caregivers or people who might have a long commute or people who might not have the financial sort of capacity to do some of those things, or may not know how to play golf, right? Because they didn't learn and it wasn't something that was available to them. So that can be sort of the get on board culture that, again, sort of actually alienates people and makes people feel that they can't be their authentic self. Because they've got to pretend and fake being something or doing things that they don't really want to do. And you often find that, you know, and I hate really stereotyping, but you do find that often in sort of cultures where there are a lot of sort of men in leadership, a lot of male dominated type of, you know, policies and procedures, thinking that this is a one size fits all for everyone. The third culture is, it's sort of funny. It's called the fear-based culture. And it's sort of funny because when I have a little culture quiz on my website that is literally 9 questions, takes a few minutes. And we often see that when people take the quiz, you know, folks that are prospective clients or just people that I might share it with at a keynote, and they get the results of this fear-based culture, they always take the quiz again, because they don't want that answer to be real. And it is a little harsh, it's a little provocative, and that was sort of the idea behind some of these titles. But essentially, a fear-based culture is where, you know, it's the leader's kind of my way or the highway, right? So there isn't opportunity for dialogue, there isn't opportunity for people's voices to be shared. There isn't this sort of space of, hey, you know, let's kind of get these diverse ideas flowing. Let's all have an opportunity to, you know, to make mistakes, right? To learn from our mistakes, to learn, grow, all of those things. And that shuts people down, right? And it becomes fearful because you are feeling like you are walking on eggshells and you don't want to say something because of fear of retaliation, right? And so you endure, maybe humiliation, you endure bullying, you endure sort of a very unpleasant and uncomfortable work environment because of fear. And fear that if you say something, something will happen to you, or if you say something, you'll be sort of penalized and put in the, you know, put in the penalty box, right? Or marginalized, or not given a promotion or whatever. And all three of those are not places where you can sort of really be your full authentic self, where you can really, you know, challenge your ideas, bring your best self into the workplace, where you can live into your strengths. You know, it's not a place where you feel like you can be, you know, part of the company's growth and feel like you, you know, that you're an owner of the business, not necessarily a financial owner, but that you are so fully committed to growing and scaling your organization or changing your organization or serving your members or whatever it is. And so that kind of leads to that fourth type of culture that we really want to aspire to, which is that belonging culture where we can really be our full authentic selves. And the last thing I'll say about these four types is often often people are, or organizations are sort of really a mixture of a, you know, a couple. And it's rare that we, an organization that has absolutely no elements of a belonging culture, there's always something there, but it is not necessarily something that everyone experiences, right? So the folks that are part of this, like, you know, fear-based or get on board culture are actually experiencing being a part of it. For them, it feels like a belonging culture, right? Because it's what they want. but it's the experience across the board that we're looking for.
Shara, something else that I found particularly insightful in your book was your examination of how millennials approach leadership and the impact they and Gen Z will undoubtedly have on an organization's culture. Over the past several months, I've been talking and working with millennial leaders, and it's hard not to be impressed by how values-driven they are. They know what matters to them, what they want to see from their employer, and what they want to change and make better. And to build on what you had shared about the challenge where some organizations will say, you know, we're innovative and bold as having one of our values, many of these young leaders have shared how often they are chastised or even censored for expressing their viewpoints because, quite frankly, what they're sharing challenges the status quo that benefits the dominant group, it benefits those in the senior leadership circles, and it's often at times they admit is at the expense of minority groups. So clearly a change is needed here, especially if we want organizations to not only have this culture of belonging, but that we have a workplace environment that attracts and retains the people we're going to need in light of the growing talent shortage. And there's been numerous studies that show how younger employees are really driven to want to work in a very diverse, welcoming workplace environment. And in your book, you write how to begin this process, what we need to do here is to change our mindset about how we view and understand our younger employees and leaders. So in this context, Shara, how do we go about changing our mindset so as to help foster a more inclusive and belonging culture?
Great question, right? and a tough thing to do in terms of changing mindset. But what I share with folks is I actually go back to sort of my early sort of life, right? Where you may have noted in the book that I was born in India, I lived in Nigeria, I went to school in England, I lived in Greece, and then I came to the U.S. So essentially, an immigrant. I've lived here, you know, 30 years or so or more. And the important parts of, you know, the reason I share that story is because having to move around and live in different countries and navigate a lot of things sort of on my own, right? Because my parents remained in Nigeria when I went back to India to live with my grandparents, and then I was in a boarding school in England. I had to really lean into curiosity, and I had to like leave any judgment behind, which is really hard. And so if you want to, you know, changing the mindset is sort of just giving yourself pause and saying, let me sort of get to know this individual or, you know, several individuals without any judgment, without any stereotypes, and with really leaning into it with curiosity and with a desire to discover and to learn about them. And the more questions you ask, right, that's what curiosity is about. If you ask questions and really listen, you'll start to learn about what drives them, what motivates them, why they're approaching things differently, right? And you can kind of learn all that context, and you can clue into what is sort of different, and what you might think as, oh, they're slackers or they're lazy or whatever, right? Kind of big statement you're making about an entire generation of 70 million people is you'll sort of realize, wait a second, this isn't true, right? Mm-hmm. And so I would just offer to folks, just make a commitment to say, I'm going to try to be curious for a week or two. And let me see what happens if I ask questions and listen, reflect, and maybe share a story from my own sort of upbringing, right? And you'll sort of find that the experiences that we have, you know, sort of drive the expectations and the mindsets that we have. And the fact that when you listen to people having different experiences, that lends itself to you recognizing sort of their motivations, their drivers, and why they feel the way they feel. I mean, why do they want to work in more diverse organizations? Well, because they are millennials and Gen Zs are much more diverse, right? Because we have just a different sort of mix of demographics now in sort of North America, right? I don't really know a whole lot about Canada, but certainly in the US, right? We are, the US is getting browner. There's much more mixed race kids, particularly with Gen Z. And understanding that mindset and their experiences is going to be key to not only sort of learning how to work with them, but learning to work with anyone or living with anyone that is different from you and didn't come up in the same sort of monolithic or have that same monolithic experience.
Now, another astute point you share in your book is how leaders may learn how to be good at building and leading successful teams, but they don't learn how to be more intentional and aware of the kind of culture they're promoting in their organization, which in some ways is ironic because leaders are repeatedly being told that their employees are watching what they say and do to learn what really matters and what's really expected of them, which serves to inform the organization's culture. And there's a story you share here that I think really helps to illustrate this reality that I was wondering if you could share. And it's the story you write about an HR director called Nora and how her organization addressed the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement in light of the murder of George Floyd and other innocent Black people in the U.S.
Yeah. No, that's Nora is a great story. Interesting firm, right? So she works at the small communications firm, and she really was very invested and focused on DEI and leading a legacy of justice in her organization. And this was a place where, you know, the organization was seemingly committed, or so they said they were. They were committed to DEI, and they wanted to create a more inclusive environment. And they were sort of in favor of Nora sort of leading those efforts, right? But here's kind of where you have to sort of put your money where your mouth is, so to speak, right? And understand that, are you going to walk the talk? And so there was a situation kind of in, you know, in kind of the summer of 2020, where Nora started to receive phone calls and messages and emails and all of this stuff, kind of just, you know, her inbox and phone was sort of blowing up. And there was this Facebook post where one of the firm's employees and her and the employee's kid were at a protest, and they were, you know, throwing stuff at the they were throwing stuff at the other protesters who were supporting Black Lives Matter. So actually there was a Black Lives Matter march, and then the folks were protesting it, and things got violent, right? And how this all sort of came to her attention is that they were wearing a t-shirt of the firm. And so when all of this sort of first blew up, she goes to the leadership and she says, oh my gosh, here's what's happening. And they're like, oh my gosh, yes, let's take you know, let's sort of shut things down. Let's kind of work to reprimand the employee. And, you know, they were all in favor. However, they were in one of our sort of mid-Atlantic to southern states, and their conservative clients started to call and say, why are you doing this? Why did you fire the employee? Why did you reprimand the employee? You know, this is not cool. And the leadership started to backtrack, right? Because they didn't want to lose the clients. They didn't want to deal with the pressure. And this is where you know, when you say you want to do something, whether it's with a value or whether it's with a belief or a mindset or how you want to really lead your business, you really need to think about what are the consequences? What are all the things that can happen? And am I going to really be strong when I have to deal with the adversity, right? Because it's easy to say you support something when there's no conflict around it. Mm-hmm. But the moment you get pushback, what are you going to do, right? How are you going to handle that? And you can't be sincere. And, you know, these leaders appeared to be very sincere, but when it mattered, they retreated. And, you know, more and more, going back to our conversation with millennials and Gen Zs, they are expecting the leaders of an organization to take a stand. And they're expecting more and more for those leaders to take a stand for social justice, right? For DEI, for women's rights, like all of those things that in the past have been political, have been taboo. Well, they are still to be political, but they've been taboo and not to be discussed in the workplace, right? But now when you're talking about, I want to work in a belonging culture, I want to feel like I can bring my full self, those issues are really important. And they are really important to these two generations, right? That are that grew up differently, have different perspectives than the baby boomers that are still mostly in leadership positions, and some of us Gen Xers. So that was just a very disheartening situation. Nora sort of had come into this organization with a lot of excitement and a lot of belief that she was empowered to make change, and then all of this stuff happens, right? They remove the statement. They shut things down on the social media, and she eventually was like, "I can't be here. I want to work in a place where there's window dressing, right? I actually need my leadership to to stand through the tough times, right? And to make those hard decisions. That's what differentiates you as a leader. It's how are you going to react when there's a storm out there, right? And how are you going to navigate and guide your organization and the people in it? And how do you sort of stand up for people that are being stepped upon, right? So yeah, that was a very tough situation.
Well, I have to tell you, Shara, how much Nora's story resonated with me, as I've had Black, Brown, and Indigenous leaders and employees share with me their experience of how their company proclaimed to have an inclusive and caring culture, and yet when they tried to share their grief and pain about some conflict around the world or a recent incident that happened in their community, they were warned about causing trouble or were told how, quote, now is not the time to bring such things up.
Yeah.
And honestly, it's heartbreaking to hear how there was this lack of empathy at organizations that were happy to join in on supporting Black Lives Matter and other recent movements to show their company supports the rights of other marginalized groups, but then internally, they're censoring their own employees and leaders because it wasn't convenient for the senior management to display empathy, care, and concern.
Right.
And I honestly don't think these leaders realize what they're communicating about the real culture of their organization. So in light of Nora's story, which sadly is more common than I think most of us realize, what are some measures leaders should be taking to ensure they are consistently communicating and demonstrating what their culture is or what they want it to be, even when it might be difficult and not convenient and easy to do?
Well, it goes back to Tanvir, and lots of great questions here, but it goes back to, having sort of really intentionality and dialogue around this. So, I think we sort of spoke earlier that yes, there's more focus on culture, and that's a great thing for people like you and me, right? Because it sort of surrounds everything we do. But there's still a belief that you can, just because you say it, it makes it so. And that's not the case, right? Culture is about the way we do things around here. It's about the decisions, the daily interactions, the norms, the rituals. It's sort of in the minutiae and the granularity of our days and our interactions with our colleagues and our clients and the public and all of that. So you communicate your culture by what you do, not what you say. I mean, certainly what you say is important, right? In terms of, hey, this is what I want. But as you mentioned earlier, so rightly, our employees are looking at us, right? And they're saying, how are they acting? What are they doing? Is their body language matching their words, right? Is everything they're saying, really in harmony? Or are they just throwing out words like, yeah, I support Black Lives Matter, and I've made, thousands of dollars or hundreds of thousands of dollars of donations to XYZ organizations? That's kind of an easy or convenient thing. So you communicate that culture by the actions that you take every day. And when you say you want to be inclusive or support Black Lives Matter, or that empathy is an important part of this organization, or whatever those things are that you say, care and compassion, curiosity, whatever, you've got to really think about, Okay. And challenge yourself, right? Which means that you need to talk as a leadership team. You need to really have honest reflection and dialogue around, so what are we going to do when things get tough, right? What are we going to do when our biggest client says, I don't support the direction you're going? Are you going to say, oh, sorry, client. Yeah, sorry, client, we misstepped. We'll kind of correct all of that, like they did at Nora's firm. Or are they going to say, hey, client A, let's really get into a conversation about this. Let me sort of tell you why this is important to us and why we feel this is important to our organization and actually how it's going to be beneficial to you, right? Because we can actually attract a broader set of really top talent when we demonstrate that we're inclusive, when we sort of really open the doors and we allow people to kind of to lean into who they really need to be and who they want to be, and they can bring their innovative ideas and they can experiment, and they're led by people who think about them as people and all of those things, right? That we want to really align purpose, that we want to really align and nurture our talent, and we want to create that community. And we can't do those things that we know drives positive culture and positive employee engagement if we sort of pick and choose, or we don't really stand by our beliefs. That said, believe it as a leader, then honestly, you're just better off like not speaking to it, right? Which is a hard thing to say, but if you're not ready to go there, then maybe you shouldn't make those statements, right? And think about where you are ready and what you are committed to doing.
So, Shara, I want to talk with you about one of the topics that I speak of in my work, and that is how leaders can create a sense of community in their organization. And I love how you tie community to employees finding a sense of purpose in what they do, which honestly can seem daunting, especially if we've never given ourselves time to think and reflect on what our purpose is. This is something I've been working on with one of my executive coaching clients, and I remember when I started this discussion with this executive where I asked him to define what is his leadership purpose. He had a really hard time with this. He could easily tell me what his goals were for his team, what changes he wanted to implement, but it took him some time to understand what is his why. And I love how you connect here being a purpose-driven leader with creating a culture that fosters a sense of belonging and community. And again, there's a story you share here that I think really helps to bring this point across, and it's the story of the mattress company Lisa, and how they rallied their employees around changing the way they created products during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Yeah, one of the other stories I talk about in the book is this is an organization called Lisa, which is a mattress manufacturer that had a very purpose-driven mission. Their leaders were very purpose-driven, and so they weren't just about making mattresses, right? They were really they wanted to make mattresses in a different way, but they also supported their local community by donating a mattress for every 10 that they sold. And so the people, in terms of purpose, right, their leaders had the sense of we want to create community inside and outside the organization. We want to have our purpose aligned with the mission of the organization. We want to have people's purpose aligned with kind of what we want to do, right? So it was about giving back to their community, and particularly to the community where people did not have homes and they did not have a place to stay. And so they shared the mattresses they donated went to sort of the homeless community, or people who supported the homeless community, right, through shelters and things like that. And really the power of all of this came together during COVID when they were, we know there was a shortage of beds and hospital beds in particular, and they had to figure out how to. They wanted to provide beds to the hospital, but they had a 9-month process of design and manufacturing, and they're like, "Well, this is not going to work when we need beds yesterday." And so they all came together, rallied around that purpose, rallied around their sense of community, both in and inside and outside of the organization. And they were able to shorten the life cycle from 9 months to 3 weeks. And they were able to produce these mattresses and get them in the hands of the hospitals who needed them, right? And so this is when you are sort of so motivated and driven by kind of your why. And in this case, you know, many of these leaders had sort of the why of impact, like I said, and impact to community and wanting to leave things in a better state and to really make a difference in the homelessness in their community, that drove them to really change their mindset, right? And change their process and allow employees, which was also more powerful, as they galvanized the employee community to help make that a reality of shifting from the 9 months to the 3 weeks to do that, because they were all centered around that. And you can't do that if your heart is really not in it, right? Like, you've got to connect the head and the heart, you know, and the wallet at times to bring everything to life. So this is not sort of a whole bunch of touchy-feely stuff, right? It's how do you really ensure that when you're talking about the full person, it's, you know, the intellectual part, the emotional part, and even sort of the financial impact of what's going to happen.
Now, I know some people who are listening right now might be thinking, well, I could see for Lessa how, given the product they create, they can foster that sense of purpose and community amongst their employees. But given what my organization does, what product or service we create, I just don't see us having an opportunity like that. And I often encounter that kind of resistance from leaders. But I point out to them that there's always opportunities for their employees to find a sense of purpose and meaning in what they do. But I'd love it, Shara, if you could share here what you need to do to foster a culture that promotes a true sense of belonging and community for everyone in your organization.
So, yeah, I agree with you that there's always purpose in what you do. So if you serve, you know, if you're a public servant, right, if you choose to go into sort of that world, you're going in not for getting rich, right? Because that's not going to happen. But you're going in because you really care about the local community, the state, the federal, the larger country, whatever it is, that you want to serve the public. And that is your purpose, that you want to give back in whatever way. People join the military, right? Because they have this duty to protect their country. You can be a government contractor, let's say, and you are serving the government clients because you align to their mission. And, you know, if you think about organizations that serve the military community as clients, or they serve the civilian side, right? There's different alignments. And there's some people that are thrilled to work with, kind of, let's say, an environmental organization. And then there are others that are less motivated by working for, the EPA in the US, but they're absolutely galvanized in the public sector mode by working for serving the Marine Corps, the US Navy in a contracting capacity, right? And so then take that into kind of the work that we do, or the clients that we might serve. So they might be a nonprofit, or they might be a member association, or they might be a law firm, or, you know, whatever it is. Like, why are you doing what you're doing? If you're only going into it to make money or for a job or to pay the bills, then most likely you or the employees you hire are not going to really do their best work, right? So think about your talents, think about your strengths, think about the things that are important to you, think about the things that you're passionate about. And that is how you get that sense of purpose and how you bring on talent that feels like, hey, this is part of I can be a part of this community because these are the things that are important to me. And you therefore feel like that you sort of really belong in that community, right? So it's potentially also looking at talent that might not fit the exact mold that you are expecting, right? And so we talk about talent fit and talent add, and how do you really bring talent into the organization that's certainly going to feel a connection to the community and the purpose that's there, but then might have different lived experiences that they can contribute to make the place, the community richer, and to make that sense of belonging richer for everybody else. So I very much believe that you can find purpose in what you do. For me, my purpose is in really helping other organizations bring their culture to life, right? And to create these places, these organizations where everybody can thrive. That is something that's really, really important to me. And that's why I left sort of a, you know, corporate cushy kind of life to say, no, I'm going to venture out on my own and I'm going to see how I can sort of really live into this desire to help leaders create these organizations and communities that people can thrive. And why is that important for me? Well, I have two Gen Z kids, right? They're 20 and 18 right now. And I don't want them to have the undesirable experiences that many of my peers did, many of the people I've worked with have had, where they've worked in organizations, right, that are fear-based or good old boy or kind of nice, and they haven't really been able to bring their full selves into the organization. So you can find purpose wherever it is. You just have to really think hard about what that purpose is. And I can say that the first 20 years of my life where I worked in, HR and culture roles, and I was progressing, I enjoyed my work. You know, I enjoyed the people I worked with. There was a little bit of purpose that was being filled. But when I really reflected, I was like, I'm never going to be happy. And I'm going to constantly be looking for new jobs because what's really not getting filled is that sense of purpose, right? Mm-hmm. And the paycheck can grow, but that doesn't really, that's really not motivating me at the end of the day.
Well, Shara, as I said at the start of our conversation, I enjoyed reading your book for how you address some of the topics I discussed through my work speaking and working with executives, as well as how your book addresses some of the challenges people have shared with me about how their organizational culture is frankly not as inclusive or welcoming as we might think it is, that it's like you said in my experiences, they're really more nice cultures than belonging cultures. And so I'm grateful to have you share your insights on what we can all do to ensure we address these gaps and failures so we can foster workplaces where everyone has the opportunity and means to succeed and thrive. So thank you, Shara, for the wonderful conversation and guidance.
Yeah, my pleasure, Tanvir. Thanks so much for having me on your show. I love that we had this chance to connect, and I look forward to staying in touch.
If you'd like to learn more about Shara and her book, check out the show notes for this episode on our podcast page at tanvirnasir.com/LBC. And if you'd like to learn more about my speaking work, check out my speaking page on my website, where you can learn more about the topics I share in my keynotes and corporate training sessions, as well as what leaders in attendance had to say about the insights and ideas I shared at these events. I'd also like to ask you to do me a favor and take a moment now to rate and review my podcast on your favorite streaming platform to help others discover and benefit from listening to my podcast. I'm Tavin Nasir, and you've been listening to Leadership Biz Cafe.